Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Dana M. Chase, MD, about Endometrial Cancer Awareness Month, which is observed annually in September. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Chase discussed the management of recurrent endometrial cancer, emphasizing the importance of biomarker profiles and previous therapies. For first recurrences, she explained that carboplatin and paclitaxel with pembrolizumab or dostarlimab is recommended for patients with mismatch repair deficient disease, whereas those with mismatch repair proficient disease may benefit from carboplatin, paclitaxel, and pembrolizumab or lenvatinib. She also highlighted findings from the Phase 3 RUBY trial that supported the FDA approval of dostarlimab, showing significant improvements in progression-free and overall survival in both dMMR and pMMR patients. Dr. Chase also noted the rising incidence of endometrial cancer, its deadly nature, and the importance of clinical trials for advancing treatment options. So just speaking about some topics in endometrial cancer for Endometrial Cancer Awareness Month this month, just to start off, how do you typically treat patients who have recurrent endometrial cancer?
When you have a patient with recurrent endometrial cancer, it's helpful to know what the characteristics of their cancer are. So these days, the biomarker profile of the endometrial cancer is really important. For example, is it proficient in mismatch repair? Is it deficient in mismatch repair? Is it, which we call pMMR, dMMR? Is it HER2 2 plus or 3 plus? Is it P53 wild type or mutated? It's also important to know when their last therapy was and what their last therapies were. So have they gotten immunotherapy previously? Was their last chemotherapy 6 months ago? Was it 3 months ago? Was it 12 months ago? So there's a lot of different factors that play into how you're going to treat that recurrent endometrial cancer. You know, even 10 or 15 years ago, it was probably that we would just treat these patients all the same way with the same chemotherapies, the same approach to sequencing and treatment. But these days, we've been able to really refine the recommended treatments based on the biomarker profile and the patient's previous therapies.
How do you determine whether to add chemotherapy to an immunotherapy regimen for patients with recurrent disease?
If this is the patient's first recurrence, and let's say the patient previously had radiation alone, meaning they didn't get chemotherapy at all, they just had radiation, they're new to chemotherapy. So in that situation with recurrent disease that's not amenable to another surgery or to radiation treatment, that patient I would treat with carboplatin paclitaxel, and I would consider the addition of immunotherapy. The addition of an immunotherapy agent is very important for the patients that are deficient in mismatch repair proteins. So patients that are dMMR, I would definitely approach that patient with treating that patient with carboplatin paclitaxel and an immunotherapy agent. There are two immunotherapy agents that are both anti-PD-1 antibodies. One is pembrolizumab and the other one is dostarlimab. And I would choose between one of those to add to the carboplatin paclitaxel in recurrent disease. Now, it becomes a little trickier when the patients already had chemotherapy. So let's say they had carboplatin paclitaxel, and this is their first recurrence, and they've been exposed to chemotherapy previously. In that situation, for a dMMR patient, if they've never had immunotherapy, it's a no-brainer for me. I would give them carboplatin paclitaxel, and I would add either dostarlimab or pembrolizumab. Now, if that patient is a pMMR patient, so they're proficient in MMR, and they've gotten carboplatin paclitaxel before, your options are to give them carboplatin paclitaxel again and possibly add an immunotherapy to that doublet therapy, meaning dostarlimab or pembrolizumab. Or there's another option for those patients, which is to treat them with pembrolizumab and lenvatinib. And so pembrolizumab and lenvatinib, which we call LenPem, is a non-chemotherapy option for that pMMR patient. And that's really helpful because many times these patients who've gotten carboplatin and paclitaxel previously, they don't want to get chemo again. They don't want to lose their hair again. They don't want to feel as tired or as sick, you know, get neuropathy, for example, or lose their hair. Those are the two considerations that might drive that patient to get lenvatinib and pembrolizumab. The treatment of recurrent disease and adding immunotherapy to it really depends on the patient's profile. When was their last chemotherapy? What are their biomarkers? What are the tumor characteristics, for example? And then what side effects did the patient have previously that potentially they're carrying or they still have from their last treatment?
So dostarlimab plus chemotherapy, as we know, you know, received expanded FDA approval in 2024 for patients with primary advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer. Can you just briefly highlight some of the data that supported this approval from the RUBY Part 1 trial?
On the RUBY trial, it was a randomized phase 3 trial. And so the patients were randomized to carboplatin paclitaxel with dostarlimab, followed by dostarlimab maintenance for up to 3 years, versus carboplatin paclitaxel with a placebo, followed by a placebo for up to 3 years. And on that trial, one of the primary kind of efficacy endpoints was overall survival and progression-free survival in the all-comer group, so in everybody, DMMR and PMMR combined. And then another primary efficacy endpoint was to look specifically at the DMMR patients and what their progression-free survival was. And so on that trial, we saw statistically significant improvements in both progression-free and overall survival in the overall population, so DMMR and PMMR combined. And we saw significant improvements in progression-free survival in the DMMR group. And what's pretty incredible about the results is that once those curves start to separate, those survival curves start to separate, they maintain that separation. So that response, that difference between the two arm is maintained over time. And there's, at this point, over 3 years of follow-up data to go by. Other important characteristics of that trial are that it included high-risk histology. So it included a carcinosarcoma patients, it included serous, it included clear cell, and it included mixed histologies, including dedifferentiated types. So there were high-risk histologies. And in addition, it included patients that had had chemotherapy only 6 months ago. So the treatment-free interval had to be at least 6 months, but those patients, some of those patients had a relatively short treatment-free interval. And then what else is interesting about the trial is that while most of the patients had to have measurable disease after surgery, for example, if it was a primary advanced, not a recurrent patient, if they had surgery, most of them had to have measurable disease. But on the trial, there were some patients that did not have measurable disease. Like, for example, if you had a stage 3C, but you were a high-risk histology, like carcinosarcoma, clear cell, or serous, you did not have to have measurable disease after surgery. Or if you had endometrioid type and you had positive periaortic nodes at time of surgery, you did not have to have measurable disease. So unlike some of the other trials, there were patients, not a ton of them, but there were some patients with non-measurable disease.
Based on, you know, this approval, kind of how has this expanded approval affected your practice? And, you know, in particular, are there any benefits or challenges really associated with using dostarlimab in this broader patient population?
Based on the RUBY trial, we do have the ability to use dostarlimab with carboplatin paclitaxel followed by dostarlimab maintenance in all comers, meaning patients that are PMMR or DMMR, meaning patients that are proficient in the MMR proteins or patients that are deficient in the MMR proteins. We can use it in all comers, in everybody. And so that that's helpful in that we have more options for our patients. I will say that while for me, it's a no-brainer to use it in a DMMR patient, meaning in a patient that's deficient in MMR, if they have advanced disease and this is their first treatment, or if they have recurrent disease and they've had either previous chemotherapy or not, for that DMMR patient, It's a no-brainer for me to use carboplatin paclitaxel and dostarlimab or pembrolizumab, because that's another option that we have to use. And then for the PMMR patient, it becomes a little more nuanced. While I have this option to use carboplatin paclitaxel and immunotherapy, either dostarlimab or pembrolizumab, for the PMMR patient, it's more of a shared decision-making with the patient. There was, based on the GY01A trial, a significant improvement in progression-free survival in the PMMR patients. And based on the RUBY trial, although it was an exploratory endpoint, like an exploratory analysis, there looked like there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival in the PMMR patients as well. So there is an improvement in outcomes in those patients. The question is whether or not that's clinically significant. And that's a discussion that I'll have with the patient, like how much of a clinical benefit are they okay with to add this additional treatment to their regimen that might have toxicity. So that's for the PMMR patient. It's great to have options, but it's more of a shared decision-making with that patient.
Overall, you know, what is the importance of recognizing Endometrial Cancer Awareness Month, and sort of what is your message for colleagues?
Yes, it's great that we have new therapies for our endometrial cancer patients. It's great that for some of our endometrial cancer patients, we're really moving the bar on survival, meaning improving survival. I would say that looking forward, and also just in general regarding endometrial cancer, we have to remember that it's one of the cancers that's on the rise. It's the fourth most common cancer in women, but it's on its way to surpass colon cancer and become the third most common cancer in women. So it's one of the cancers in the United States that's on the rise. In addition, it's become even more deadly than ovarian cancer. So it's now in the top 10 most deadly cancers in women as well. So in certain groups, for example, we are seeing that certain patients are more likely to die of endometrial cancer than other patients. So I think raising awareness about the symptoms of endometrial cancer are really important. So making sure patients know that, for example, it's not normal to have bleeding after menopause, even if it's a spot, even if it's just a pinkish discharge, for example, that's not normal, that they should go see a doctor and tell them about their symptom, even if it's just one time. I think it's very important to educate postmenopausal women about that any bleeding is abnormal postmenopause. And then for premenopausal women, I will say, if you've had a certain pattern of your menstruation your whole life and that changes, like all of a sudden you're having more bleeding or heavier periods or bleeding in between periods, that's also a reason to go in to see the gynecologist, that's not something to ignore. So I think it's just important to spread the word about the symptoms so we can hopefully continue to see women present in an early stage as opposed to advanced stage. And then one more thing that I'll just mention is that there is an association between obesity and endometrial cancer. And so definitely women that are obese, meaning have a BMI over 30, that those women are higher risk for endometrial cancer. So anything that we can do to reduce obesity in the United States should hopefully also help reduce the accelerated incidence of endometrial cancer. The reason why we have this new immunotherapy to use in endometrial cancer patients is because thousands of women agreed to participate in clinical trials. And I think there's a misunderstanding about going on clinical trials and feeling like a guinea pig, like we're testing things on you that could hurt you, that won't help you, you're just a guinea pig, that kind of a thing. But really, you have to remember that the reason why we've made progress in the treatment of gynecologic cancers is because of women or patients being willing to participate on clinical trials. And so the only way we're going to continue to make progress is with patients' willingness to participate in clinical trials. So I encourage patients and oncologists to look for clinical trials for their patients and for patients to also ask about clinical trials, because you never know, one might be available for you. And this is the only way we're really going to advance the science and make treatments better.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Onc Live is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at Onc Live. On Facebook, like us at Onc Live, and follow our Onc Live page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Onc Live On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Onc Live On Air.